All right, everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Crypto 101 podcast. I'm joined, as always, by my notorious co-host, Mr. Aaron Pizza Mind Malone. Aaron, how are we doing today, brother?
I'm doing very well. We had a crazy thunderstorm last night here in Texas. Just lightning shooting off every 2 or 3 seconds. It was really wild, but I'm settling in really well. I feel like a Texan. I've got my official Texan license. I got cowboy boots. I even ordered my very first cowboy hat, so I'm very proud of that.
It only took about a year of you being in Texas to finally feel part of the landscape there.
Yeah, it really did. But, you know, I'm really looking to integrate myself further into the culture. If only there was some way to, like, merge oil and crypto together. You got anything like that for me, Bryce?
You know, I really don't. Although, as we see, you know, commodity prices of oil have been absolutely nuts. But, you know, we're actually joined by a fellow, the CEO and the founder from Euler.
It is Euler,
right?
It is Euler.
It is Euler.
It's spelled
differently. I thought it was Euler the whole time, because when I took algebra way back in sophomore year of high school, that's how my sophomore teacher pronounced it, and it was being mispronounced. And so regardless, we're joined today by Michael Bentley of Euler. So Michael, welcome to the show, and how are we doing today?
Yeah, thank you for having me. Bryce, I feel like there was a great gag there from Aaron that went over the top of your head about how do you mix oil and crypto with the Euler pronunciation? I'm doing really well, thank you. And happy to tell you about the pronunciation. It definitely catches, I would say, 99% of people out.
Yeah, speaking of going right over your head, I don't even know what an Euler is. I failed math class. Can you tell us what's with the name? Give us the background just on that. And it's spelled E-U-L-E-R, not O-I.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. There is another project, I think, called Euler with an OI as well. So,
We don't care about that.
Forget those guys, whatever they're doing. Yeah, EU. So Euler, really nerdy sort of backstory to this one. Euler was a very famous mathematician from Switzerland who was knocking around in the 18th century. Probably one of the most prolific mathematicians of all time. And he was known for many, many things. Among them, though, was the study of the compound interest rate formula. And that's, of course, the link here to lending and borrowing, of course, compound interest being what you would earn as a yield on a lending protocol like Euler. So compound, of course, from Robert and the team over there, they probably took the best name, and we were trying to look for something else lending related. And
so is the EU named after him too?
That's good question. No, I suspect not on that one, but he does have a lot of things named after him. Actually, he even has his own special number, Euler's number.
What?
Have a number? It's like 2.3 or something, right?
What do I have to do to get a number?
Yeah, you can just pick one and claim it. We can call it Aaron's number.
Jeez.
Well, I love it.
Retired in the podcast Hall of Fame, whatever that may be.
Yeah. Michael, let's back up. Let's get back to the basics here for folks who are just joining Crypto 101. Maybe this is their first time listening to a Crypto 101 podcast. They're just trying to, you know, figure out what's this DeFi landscape, what's borrow, lend. Like, can we kind of zoom out? And what's this DeFi space to you? What's it enabling that's so important that made you kind of want to stake your life on it, basically, over here and starting something like this?
Yeah, DeFi is super powerful because it's essentially the disintermediation of finance. So a little bit of kind of a word salad there, but I think ultimately it's taking middlemen out of finance. And that means that it's more sort of democratic for everybody else. When you go and deposit your cash in a bank, that cash will usually be lent out to other borrowers, people, you know, taking mortgages, maybe people borrowing from credit cards, maybe people in traditional finance and so on, speculating, all sorts of folks. But as it works its way through the system, there's an awful lot of intermediaries there taking their cut along the way, which means ultimately that you as the lender, you get a kind of pittance back in the way of an interest rate on your deposits. So that's one of the issues that DeFi solves, I think, is it takes out those middlemen, those intermediaries.
It's funny. It's like it seems like there's such a spread or a discrepancy, if you will, between the rate that I'll get as a saver or a lender to the bank. You know, maybe I'll get 0.01% in my savings account, or if I'm in a high interest savings account, maybe 0.05% or whatever. And then as a borrower, I could be the same person borrowing from the same institution, maybe even the same term. And I'm, you know, borrowing at, you know, maybe 5% interest rate, or if I'm on a credit card, a 20%. And it's funny because all of that spread, you're like, well, where did it all go? Right. Well, the bank needs to pay their you know, shareholders out, right? Through whether it's a dividend or through share buybacks, they need to pay their customer support team and all their thousands and thousands of employees and their overhead for all their physical locations. And you say, oh, well, banks are pretty freaking inefficient for the role that they're playing. And I think that's what, you know, Bitcoin and Ethereum and Euler and all these amazing DeFi protocols really kind of like blew the clothes off the emperor. And it's like, hey, we could do everything a bank is doing, and we could do it for a fraction of the cost at a, you know, thousand times, you know, speed up. It's just so wild what we've got.
Yeah. Here. It's also extremely composable, right? If I want to sort of establish a bank account, it usually takes me, you know, several weeks. And once I'm there, I'm extremely sticky. I'll be honest. I think I've been with my bank since the age of 17. So I'm double that now in age. So they've had me as a customer for a long time. I'm extremely sticky. If I wanted to, if there's a better rate of interest at another bank, I tend not to switch, right? And there's all these massive inefficiencies in the system because it's not composable. It's very difficult to move from one component of finance to another without signing up, filling out a load of forms, getting a bunch of licenses and so on. In DeFi, everything's so connected. You know, people often call them money Legos, where different types of financial type products or protocol software running on the blockchain can process this stuff and can be hooked in. So if there's a better rate elsewhere, you can have a piece of code that will just automate you moving from, you know, one bank or type of protocol to another very, very quickly and seamlessly. And that's very, very powerful. And then, of course, the other big you know, advantage here is the decentralization component, which means ultimately there's not some centralized controller running things that you have to, you know, put your faith in. And I'm very lucky. I live in the UK, and for the most part, I mean, I wouldn't say I trust our government right now, but I don't tend to worry too much about you know, the bank running off with funds or the government, you know, censoring me. But lots of people around the world do live in countries where that is a genuine concern. And so I think for those people, it's nice that we have this technology now where they can look after their own assets without having to worry about central controllers you know, running the show and shutting them down.
Yeah, this is maybe, you know, where a key term in the crypto space comes in, non-custodial, right? Where you don't actually have, you know, a centralized custodian or holding company or whatever for, you know, facilitating this. It's just a piece of code that's been written and it's kind of immortalized on the Ethereum blockchain, block after block after block. And so, you know, these non-custodial app chains and blockchains and stuff are pretty interesting. But do you see there being a significant, you know, fork in the road, I guess, if you will? Because there are some platforms that are, you know, maybe going a little bit more, you know, half and half, like half DeFi, half, you know, custodianship. Do you see a future developing where there's, you know, kind of both that proliferate at the same time? Or you have a vision of, you know, pure DeFi all the way, no hybrid models would work?
No, I see shades of gray everywhere. All of this technology comes with trade-offs. Every single, you know, aspect is a trade-off. And it really depends on what you're looking for as a user. If you're trading meme coins, you know, every day, then that can be fun to do. Do you really need, you know, the decentralization that something like Ethereum can bring? Or can you just do that on a centralized server? Arguably, you can do that in a more centralized environment where probably you'll have a more user-friendly type environment as well. Decentralized systems, there is a higher barrier to entry there. to use the software. And yeah, the non-custodial stuff is also quite difficult. You are in charge of your own funds at this point, your own assets. And managing assets is not something that everybody can do. It can also be tricky. So people, I think, for ease of use, will just often look for custodians. And that's also fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But it should be on their terms and not the terms that are forced by, the country that they live in, I think.
Very well said. I've got kind of a technical question that hopefully you don't mind answering. I think a lot of our listeners are seeing the ticker symbol WETH, WETH. And they kind of wonder, what's the difference between that and my normal Ethereum tokens? And why do we see this being used in a lot of Uniswap pairs? Could you give us some commentary on just what that is and why?
Yeah, sure. So Ethereum, the network or the blockchain, has its own native unit of exchange or currency, I suppose you could call it, Ethereum, ETH, which is not a token. It's a unit of exchange to pay for transactions essentially on the Ethereum network.
But it's not an ERC-20 kind of token.
Exactly. Yeah. Most of the tokens that people are trading actually all conform to a standard, as you pointed out, called ERC-20, which was developed really early on as well in the life cycle of Ethereum. It was one of the first major standards introduced to the system, which allowed people to create tokenized assets that are fungible, which means that they're kind of like cash or stocks. They can kind of, there's, you know, no one unit that has any more value than any other unit in the total supply. Many people trade ERC-20s. There are tens of thousands of these things around these days, these tokens. And unfortunately, in many of the applications that people are buying, many of these protocols, it's often simplest just to design the systems to work for ERC-20s and to assume that the ERC-20 standard is being applied and that everything going through that system is compliant with that standard. Now, the problem there, of course, is that ETH, this native currency, is not an ERC-20. So you have to now make some special, you either have to carve out a sort of separate set of assumptions and write special code to special case this one particular type of asset going through your protocol, or you can do a cop-out, which is essentially people have written a wrapper that goes around ETH, creates something called wrapped ETH. And it's one-to-one. If you have one ETH and you wrap it, you get one wrapped ETH back. But that wrapped ETH is then ERC-20 compliant. And so that means that when you're developing a protocol, you can kind of forget about all the peculiarities of ETH as a currency and just focus on this one very clear standard, which is ERC-20.
That makes a lot of sense, actually.
We got to clip that. That's like the best explanation of wrapped tokens I've ever heard.
Yeah, it's like catching butterflies, or rather, it's like catching lightning bugs in a jar, and then you can trade that jar for a jar of honey or a jar of pickles, whatever it is. It makes a lot of sense. When you're just going to say, I've got a farm of lightning bugs in my backyard, it doesn't work so well.
Interesting.
I was just thinking about that while I was looking over the Euler website, which is beautiful, by the way. Love the color schemes. Native dark mode, big fan.
Glad you like that. Yeah, we need to get a light mode there. I mean, it's not for everyone, dark mode. I personally like it, but light mode incoming at some point.
So let's talk, high level, some of the main risks that come with a platform like Euler, DeFi lending and borrowing. We always hear about, on-chain liquidations or under-collateralized positions. Are there, collateral requirements or kind of how do you guys think about some of the main risks? And how do you guys address those?
Yeah, we've spent almost 2 years thinking about these risks. So I've got a lot to tell you on this particular topic.
But awesome.
I guess the first thing to say is that like most protocols in DeFi that deal with borrowing and lending, Euler is an over-collateralized lending protocol. And that's kind of different to how things are in the normal, ordinary day life sort of world that we live in. Essentially what over-collateralized means is if you want to, say, borrow some Bitcoin, you will need to bring in more value of another asset than you want to borrow in Bitcoin. So you might, for instance, bring in $1,000 worth of USDC and borrow $500 worth of Bitcoin.
So there's like not leverage, I guess, in the borrowing.
Well, leverage, you can actually achieve leverage using an over collateralized protocol. I'll tell you how you do it. You get a leverage position. That loan again, but we'll do $1,000 deposit of USDC, and then you borrow the Bitcoin at, say, $900 worth. So you're only just over collateralized. You can then actually take that $900 worth of Bitcoin, deposit that into Euler, and now borrow some USDC, swap that back for Bitcoin, redeposit that, swap that for USDC, buy some Bitcoin, and so on. You can essentially lever up by taking cycles.
Is this called recursive lending?
Recursive borrowing, yeah. So people do this with, there's a really complex nuance to this, where people will do this to yield farm by using the same asset. So they'll deposit and borrow the same asset over and over again in a kind of cycle. And so they'll start with, say, $1,000 worth of USDC, and their end position will be $5,000 worth of USDC deposits and $4,000 worth of USDC borrows. And so that would be like a 4x leverage position. So you've taken something where you could have just had $1,000 deposits, but now you've got five times the deposits and four times the kind of debt than the original deposit. And so you kind of leverage. And notice when you set up that kind of position, you could then just swap the deposits from USDC to Bitcoin, and then you would have a leverage long or short position on the deposited asset versus the thing you're borrowing. Generally, when you borrow and sell something, you're said to be going short on that asset. You're hoping that it drops in price so that when you come to repay that loan, it's much cheaper to repay, and so you can keep the difference.
Now, is there ever going to be a kind of a point in time where the everyday citizen can use a platform to get, you know, leverage in kind of the way that you described, but all of these processes are obfuscated, where the user at home on his application could get that leverage or get that borrow in kind of the way that you described, without having to go manually swap three, four times over, and then say, okay, now I've built my own kind of custom leveraged position? Because that, to me, is something that even the most kind of seasoned crypto trader or crypto investor is going to have a hard time, kind of putting their head around.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny you should say that. That's exactly what the UI that's built that wraps around the protocol of Euler actually enables. So you can go to the Euler app.
I didn't know that. This was not a setup.
Yeah, it sounded like a great setup. I'm rubbing my hands in glee here because that was great. Great setup for me. If you go to app.euler.finance, you'll see there's a quick action toolbar at the top there, and there's lots of actions and lots of advanced use cases. Probably a lot more actions and types of sort of trades that you can make on Euler than a lot of other lending protocols that you'll visit. But essentially what we do here to enable this functionality is we take those individual sort of units and compose them together. So like you said, there's a deposit and a swap and a borrow. And you can actually use as well under the hood some mathematical tricks to take shortcuts, which make these kind of trades a lot cheaper in terms of gas usage and transaction costs on Euler than most lending protocols. So yeah, leverage trading is definitely enabled even in an over-collateralized environment.
Did you know that May 22nd is Bitcoin Pizza Day? So on this day in 2010, a legendary Florida man paid 10,000 Bitcoin, not $10,000 worth of Bitcoin, but literally 10,000 Bitcoin for two Papa John pizzas. This dude's name was Laszlo. And now Laszlo spent, in today's terms, around $380 million. And that's just for pizzas. Pretty amazing, right? But what's more amazing is that while most of these 10,000 Bitcoin are lost, 579 coins were eventually traced back to a mysterious wallet. Now this wallet today is huge. It holds over 53,000 Bitcoin, which is worth over $2 billion today. But consider, in 2021, that would be worth over $3 billion because Bitcoin's value is a lot higher. And admittedly, that's one of the challenges of investing in Bitcoin, which is the volatility. Many people just don't have the HODL mindset. And that's why I'm stoked to tell you about another intriguing alternative. No, it's not an altcoin. It's not an ape NFT. No, listen, it's still flying under the radar of most of the mainstream media. And I'm excited to offer my listeners the ability to get priority access. So if you want the rest of the story, go to masterworks.io/crypto101. Again, to get the rest of the story, head over to masterworks.io/crypto101. And it's super important that you see the important Regulation A disclosures as well at masterworks.io/CD. Now, if you want everything last time, that's masterworks.io/crypto101. And we've got some disclosures as well in the show notes for you. Now, one of the other things that I was kind of curious about was, I guess, who is your first like target customer in kind of like regards to, do you go after, because there's always this like dilemma where it's like, do you go after, you know, the developers and do you go after the kind of like VCs and all that kind of stuff, get them excited and then have them as strategics that could kind of help, you know, acquire more customers? Or do you guys get the customers and the end users first that makes it kind of more exciting to develop on?
Yeah, interesting question. I guess as a developer of the protocol, you have the sort of the initial development sort of pipeline where, you know, you will often need support from advisors and you'll need some capital to pay salaries and so on. And then once you deploy the protocol, from there on, hopefully fairly quickly, it starts to progressively decentralize over time. And of course, at that point, it's not non-custodial. The software's running on the blockchain and is kind of out of your hands at that point, largely. Initially, I think for that first phase, yeah, it's having support of VCs and other seasoned players in the space is really, really important. They can help guide you a lot on how to set up a labs company and a developer protocol. Yeah, with all the support that requires in a very unique kind of space. I think to your question about who's the kind of target audience for this, though, as well, is on a lending and borrowing protocol, I think you have lots of different types of users, ultimately. I think on the deposit side, you have just people that tend to be looking for yield, and they can be average sort of retail users, everyday people that are fairly, you know, they're not out there interested in trading all the time. They just want to deposit their assets. They like the assets that they hold. They have a basket of different ones and they want to deposit them and come back in a year and hopefully have put those to use and earned some interest on them. On the borrowing side, especially in over-collateralized context, that pretty much everybody doing this is an active trader of some sort, or they're a professional player in DeFi. There are a lot of sort of DeFi native hedge funds, whales, people call them as well. People are out there that are able to essentially borrow assets to generate profits for themselves. They can arbitrage on exchanges and you know, do all these advanced functionalities in the trading environment. And essentially what they're doing is borrowing, making some profits and paying some of those profits back to the lenders on the protocol. So you really do have, there's a chicken and egg problem here. If you don't cater for the lenders, then you get no supply, which means there's no borrowers. And if you don't cater for the borrowers, right, then of course there's no interest being paid. So why would the lenders even show up? So,
right. Yeah, a little chicken and the egg problem.
The classic problem, yeah.
What I really like about this platform is you can really just make your own market for just about anything. And, you know, I would say my portfolio is a little bit on the exotic side. Some of the assets I hold and hold very large bags of are not supported anywhere else. Probably not even heard of anywhere else. But what's the process of, you know, making a market? Is it difficult? Do we need to apply it for anything? You know, it shows here, you know, you've got six assets for collateral, 10 are cross compatible, 42 are isolated. Then you've got 1,259 unlisted. What does that mean?
Yeah, so I think the first thing to say here is that Euler's, you know, one of the first of its kind in the lending and borrowing space to be able to handle the risks associated with lending and borrowing a vast array of different types of assets, whether or not they're you know, very volatile or liquid, very liquid. All sorts of assets can be listed on Euler, even malicious ones. And the protocol is designed from the ground up to be able to handle the risks associated with these markets. And that's not true of,
wow,
you know, most lending products. So a key component here as well is that you don't need permission from anybody to be able to activate a lending market on Euler. We build on top of Uniswap, which is a decentralized exchange, to allow users to activate their own lending and borrowing markets. And so, yeah, to your point there, if you've got something, you know, quite exotic and you currently are just holding on to it yourself, but maybe want to earn a yield on this asset, you could come on and check out the unlisted markets there and see if your asset is in the unlisted markets. You could then activate the lending market for it, deposit that asset, and then wait and see if anybody wants to borrow it to come and pay you, you know, a return. So yeah, Euler is permissionless in nature, and it's yeah, it's quite a technical challenge to be able to enable that permissionless sort of feature. But we've got lots of novel risk management tools that are specifically designed to make permissionless lending and borrowing you know, as safe as possible for users.
Wow. Well, I'm very excited about everything that Euler has going for you guys. You know, you guys just recently did a mainnet launch. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, not just back in December.
All right. And so were there any hiccups or surprises or learnings that you guys kind of drew from that? Or did it go just as smooth as planned?
No, I mean, yeah, it didn't. You always learn from everything that you do. I think if you're not, you're probably not paying attention. There's always things you can do better. It did go broadly, you know, very well, I think. Euler, we take risk management very, very seriously. So we deliberately launched the protocol in a very sort of conservative mode. We started with three robust collateral assets, not a big diverse array like you see on some other protocols. And yeah, some very conservative risk parameters that meant that people had to over-collateralize quite a bit before they could borrow, which ultimately, you know, it's not ideal for borrowers, but it does mean that the protocol is and its lenders are better protected. So that was the first thing we did to mitigate risks. In terms of what we noticed, I think one of the first things was it's crucial for lenders and borrowers to be able to understand the risks about the oracles that they're using. So the oracles in the context of a lending protocol are the providers of the prices of the assets. Mm-hmm. Prices are super important here because they determine how much people can lend or borrow. If you want to deposit, you know, one Bitcoin into the protocol and borrow some USDC, we need to know to a fairly high degree of accuracy how much Bitcoin actually is worth and how much it can be traded for USDC. If the protocol gets that wrong, and we, you know, overestimate the value of Bitcoin, then you should be able to borrow a lot more USDC than you should really be allowed to. And at that point, you might be tempted to just walk away and buy back the Bitcoin, right? And never repay that loan. So
yeah. And these Oracle attacks are super popular.
Yeah. I think there's been probably too many projects that have built with the mindset of build fast and break things. And occasionally that's led to attacks on the oracles and the manipulation of prices. So one of the things that we worked really hard on from day one is providing users with a kind of rating and a better understanding about the risks associated with oracles. Ultimately, everything's non-custodial, and so it's up to users to manage those risks, but I think it's really important to spell out what they are and how much might it cost to essentially manipulate the price of an oracle so that a user, an attacker, could gain an advantage. That's something we calculate off chain, and we actually, as the labs company, we do a lot of research on this stuff, and we then display it on the website that allows users to interact with the protocol, so that they can make their own decisions there. How much you know, if it costs £100 to move the price of something, then that doesn't sound very safe. If it costs $1 billion to move the price of something, then okay, maybe I'm comfortable using that kind of lending market. It seems quite robust to manipulation. They're the kind of decisions people have to make, and that's one of the things we've been learning throughout is how can we combine off-chain data and do analytics so that we can make the on-chain protocol a better experience for users.
Wow, I love it. Truly thorough, and you guys have just really covered all the bases. And I love the two pronged approach that at least I hear from you, where it's Euler's really going after safety first and risk management and user experience, right? And I think that that's exactly what the DeFi space needs. We've seen so many DeFi protocols go up in smokes because of poor risk management and staking and compounding and just leveraging risk on top of risk and then implosion. And then we've seen protocols that are good and safe, but they've got god awful UX and you can't even figure out how to get off the homepage. And so I think that I love your guys' approach, and I'm really excited about it. And so I kind of in closing just have a couple questions. Pete, before we get to the closing questions, did you have anything to round out that discussion? Or
no, this has been fantastic.
Awesome. And Michael, is there anything that I left out about Euler that you really wanted to make sure the audience had heard crystal clear?
No, I mean, there's lots of things I could tell you about. I could literally talk for hours on this stuff. So I would, I would say one thing that we didn't touch on so much, but which is so important for lending, and it's one of the things that Euler tries to optimize as well, which is very difficult, is capital efficiency, which is how much can you sort of squeeze out of your capital. And when we launched, as I mentioned, we launched this kind of capital inefficient state, but we've slowly been progressively increasing the capital efficiency on the protocol and also increasing the risk. Unfortunately, those two things are on sort of perpendicular
ends of the spectrum.
Yeah, that's it. So there's lots of optimizations we've made there, including stuff about interest rates and in particular liquidations, which you guys touched on before. Mm-hmm. And I think the liquidation is probably one of the biggest areas in DeFi that suffers from capital inefficiency. And I think Euler has a really unique solution for that. So I would encourage people to come and check out our pages. Our documentation pages on docs.euler.finance, and definitely come and join us in the Discord. All the labs team are there ready to answer people's questions and explain all these other features that we have.
Awesome. I definitely don't want this conversation to end, so I'm going to keep it going with a couple more personal questions, because I'm actually super curious. I saw that you attended Oxford. You got a PhD in both philosophy and I believe it was mathematical biology. Was that right?
Almost. The doctor of philosophy, the philosophy bit is just a generic thing that's like it's just an Oxford-y thing that it's just a title. So it's got nothing to do with my area of study.
Biology. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah. I was mainly studying the particular branch of that area was evolutionary game theory. So I was interested in studying essentially how populations change through time, especially in the context, how they evolve and change through time, especially in the context of social interactions being in play. So if you think about a lot of natural systems that have organisms in, the organisms are often very well adapted to their environments. And that's because natural selection is a very powerful optimizer of organisms. And so they evolve through time to fit to their environments. You know, fish swim well in water and birds can fly in air and all the rest of it, all that good stuff. But when the rest of your environment is also evolving and you're interacting with that environment through social interactions, things get really interesting and you get really interesting dynamics at play where the optimal behavior for me depends on what you do. And then I'm trying to predict what you do, you're trying to predict what I do, and we have these games at play, and this sort of game theory plays out a lot in evolutionary theory and also in DeFi as well, as it happened. So that was my area of expertise.
Yeah, and it's just such an interesting path that you took from kind of studying these patterns in nature. And then you went on to become a pricing analyst. And you kind of took that, you know, experience in biology and math, and you're like, oh, I could apply this to markets. And how, what was the overlap there? How did you see, hey, I could take all my, you know, studies and my research and actually attain better pricing forecasts?
Well, yeah, good question. I mean, I guess there's a few things to say about this. One, as a general point, the type of science I did was very interdisciplinary. So my background is, it kind of spans biology, computer science, and maths. So you end up having a broad skill set that can be applied to lots of different problems. You're more of a jack of all trades and master of none kind of thing. So
your parents must be very proud.
Thanks. Yeah, I hope so. But then, more specifically, what, you know, in relation to the actual things I was studying, I think in evolutionary game theory, you tend to take systems that are really heavily optimized, and then you want to look back in time and say, okay, well, how did they get there? What processes were at play? What was the environment like? And try to figure that out retrospectively. And in DeFi, you end up wanting to do the exact opposite. You want to construct environments and processes and incentive structures such that the end state is a heavily optimized, robust system that's hard to break. And so I kind of see the two as being, opposites of one another in some respect.
As a man who pays a very special attention to detail, can you point out any other projects, either specifically in DeFi or the crypto space in general, that I guess would meet your standards or meet your interests?
Oh, that's a good one.
Help us separate the wheat from the chaff, if you will.
Yeah. So I would say I'm a huge fan of both versions of Uniswap. I mean, I'm sure a lot of your listeners will be familiar with Uniswap, but I think the first version, which is becoming, less widely used these days because of its lack of capital efficiency, if we go back to that. But I think it was really an incredible innovation and really helped democratize the process of making markets, which is usually run by these sort of centralized, players on exchanges. So that was super, super cool. I'm a huge fan of that.
Uniswap, and you're talking about the V3 limit order functionality on Uniswap?
That's what I was coming to. Yeah, that I think is also exceptional, and that allows much higher capital efficiency. And we use Uniswap to power Euler as well. So it also provides a price oracle. And there's also a link there between Uniswap and options, which were a type of financial product, I suppose. And then the way that Uniswap V3 works, you can kind of construct, there's like this idea of an automated market maker, and there's the kind of basic version that Uniswap V2 used. And then lots of people kind of came up with all sorts of other AMMs that were of different varieties. And what's nice about Uniswap V3, I think, is that it's actually all of the above, all wrapped up into one protocol, so it can kind of replicate any AMM. And I think that's really, from a mathematician standpoint, that's really elegant and really impressive. So huge fan of Uniswap.
Awesome. I love it. I had one more question, and it's kind of a general overarching question. But like of all the trends in DeFi, DeFi is one big trend, but inside it, there's, borrow lending, there's, stable coin algos, there's, DOVs, the option vaults. Is there any like trend that's on the cusp that like most people haven't really heard about, but you're looking, you're talking in these chats with all the smartest people in crypto and building these protocols? What's like that next one that's maybe a little ways out there, but you're like, that is going to be impactful, paradigm shifting kind of stuff?
Yeah, I think I touched on it and the last comment, which is options. I think building out some kind of options protocol that runs efficiently on a blockchain. There are actually some nice protocols I really like. It runs on a layer two solution. There's a protocol called Lyra, And I really like that. My daughter is actually also called Lyra. So
hey, there we go. Is that a math thing? Is there like a famous mathematician named Lyra?
No. There's a trilogy of books called His Dark Materials, and the main character in that is a girl called Lyra. And it's a coming of age story, and it's actually set in Oxford, which was where I lived when Lyra was born. So it seemed fitting to sort of name her after this character. And then apparently it's also a constellation. And I think that's where it came from with the options trading protocol. But they're doing cool stuff. There's also cool stuff you can do where you can actually start to think about Uniswap as if you build on top of Uniswap, you can maybe construct a type of option out of Uniswap. And so all that stuff is. It involves some interesting maths, and there's some trade-offs one has to make and so on. But I think there's some really smart people working on that right now. And yeah, I think in the next 6 months to 12 months, we might see some cool stuff coming out in that area.
Love it. Love it. Michael, thank you so much for spending that full hour with us today. If people want to find out more, we'll send them to euler.finance or app.euler.finance. That's going to be in the show notes for everyone. Check them out on Twitter, Discord. You guys are all over the place. Michael, thank you so much. And we hope to have you back when you got some more big announcements, when there's a big update, whatever. You just, you know where to find us.
Yeah, I'd love to be back. Yeah, I really enjoyed talking to you guys. So thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
Absolutely. All right, everybody at home watching and listening, stay tuned. We got some more guests coming up for you later this week.